So this would be something that the president would have signed off on days before his, you know, his very delicate summit with Kim Jong-un. That just doesn't make sense.
So what is this former CIA agent talking about? You'll find out in a moment. This is Thursday, May 28th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Also ahead, the U.S. and China will try again to reach a trade agreement. The top U.S. commander says North Korea has not made strides toward denuclearization, and India claims it has placed itself into another space race. All of this and more on VOA Asia. We begin today's program with a very strange story, one that might one day turn itself into a movie. It seems that Spain is seeking the extradition of as many as 10 people from the United States who burst into the North Korean embassy in Madrid last month and tried to pass stolen information to the FBI. A Spanish judge said he believes all 10 fled to the United States after the February 22nd raid. He called them members of a criminal organization and accuses them of trespassing, burglary, assault, and threats. If extradited and convicted, those found guilty could face nearly 30 years in prison. Now, these suspects are calling themselves the Chilima Civil Defense, and they describe the group as a human rights movement working to liberate North Korea. On its website, the organization classified its Madrid action as a response to what it called an urgent situation. Joining us on VOA Asia is Bruce Klingner, who specializes in Korean and Japanese affairs as the Senior Research Fellow for Northeast Asia for the Heritage Foundation. He was a longtime employee of the CIA with a big focus in Korea. Bruce, thanks for being with us. This group's origin remains largely a mystery. What do we know about what happened?
Well, the group itself we really hadn't heard of other than they helped protect and exfiltrate the son of Kim Jong-un's half-brother who was assassinated in Macau with VX, the world's deadliest nerve agent. A few years ago, and then we hadn't really heard of them since. So here we have a very brazen break-in of the North Korean embassy in Spain, where using knives and fake guns and taking people hostage, really, and beating them, putting hoods over their heads, and then rushing away when the police were coming with stolen computers and other means. So the story hit the headlines not only because of the brazenness in North Korea, but at first Spain was saying it was CIA operatives or linked to the CIA. So that added in enough spice to certainly put it at the top of the headlines.
For sure. Now, this group, as I just mentioned, said they turned over a lot of the information they took from computers and the like inside that Spanish embassy and turned it over to the FBI. What do you think that indeed is the case?
Well, I think the FBI statement was that they may have met with these folks, but that it didn't mean involvement and they didn't confirm that they had taken anything from them. So I think the FBI may even just, people came and we talked and that may have been it. We don't know if they actually turned over anything. So again, we have sort of people making a linkage either with the CIA or the FBI, which I think is far greater linkage than is the reality.
Why do you say that? Because, again, making a really good movie script out of this is one, but is it possible, especially with your background in the CIA, that there is some linkage between this group and either the CIA or the FBI?
Well, if we think in terms of the attack or the raid itself, that would be a covert operation. Every covert operation conducted by an entity of the U.S. intelligence community under U.S. law requires what's called a presidential finding. It's a document where the president finds that in the interests of national security, a certain operation should be done. So this would be something that the president would have signed off on days before his very delicate summit with Kim Jong-un. That just doesn't make sense. Why would the president, authorize, a deal or, I'm sorry, an operation which could certainly undermine the summit if it became known? The other scenario is that it's a rogue CIA operation being done, against U.S. law and, without the president's approval. Again, days before the very important to the president summit with Kim Jong-un. Neither scenario seems very likely. And also, it's not CIA style to break into an embassy, and beat people up. I mean, if anything, CIA may try to sneak in and get information, or more likely try to recruit employees of an embassy to get information.
Well, it certainly seems that you are taking a stance that this is just something very strange and very weird that happened, maybe a rogue operation of something or even by just this group. Where do you think it all goes from here?
Well, I don't think the U.S. government was involved either before or after. It seems to be by this group whose intent is to establish a government in exile or to overthrow the North Korean regime. So, certainly their methods are over the top, but that doesn't take away from the brutalness of the North Korean regime.
Bruce Klinger specializes in Korean and Japanese affairs as the Senior Research Fellow for Northeast Asia at the Heritage Foundation. Bruce, thanks so much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
These are among the top Asia stories you'll find right now on voanews.com. The main anti-junta Fu party in Thailand says it has joined forces with six smaller parties to claim a majority of seats in the lower house of parliament and form the next government. China said Wednesday it had expelled former Interpol president Meng Hongwei from public office and the ruling Communist Party as he awaits trial on corruption charges. Myanmar holds a military parade in the city of Naypyidaw to mark that country's 74th Armed Forces Day. And Taipei Cycle, one of the biggest bicycle trade shows in Asia, opens on Wednesday. The four-day event attracts more than 1,000 exhibitors. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the voanews.com website. We continue now. American negotiators will travel to Beijing for the latest round of high-level trade talks scheduled to start March 28th. Although some hurdles remain, both the U.S. and China are expressing cautious optimism. VOA's White House correspondent Patsy Wittakuswara reports on the prospects of the two largest economies resolving their trade differences in a tariff war felt around the world.
The U.S. and China have imposed tariffs on billions of dollars worth of goods over the past year, affecting markets, businesses, and consumers. U.S. President Donald Trump seems to have no plans to give them up anytime soon.
We're talking about leaving them and for a substantial period of time, because we have to make sure that if we do the deal with China, that China lives by the deal.
Meanwhile, Beijing is gearing up for the arrival of American negotiators on Thursday for the eighth round of trade talks.
Both sides have already achieved substantive progress.
Analysts are cautiously optimistic.
And I suspect the final haggling is going to be over the details of which markets they're willing to open, and then also what kind of redress does the U.S. have if China reneges on the agreement?
The U.S. is trying to force Beijing to change what many here see as China's market-distorting trade and subsidy practices.
The Chinese have got to do something about their closed mercantilist economy. They've got to do something about forced technology transfer, the theft of intellectual property, of regulations that really exclude not just U.S. but other foreign companies.
The strategy has had mixed results. China has agreed to open up more of its markets, but is pushing back against accusations of industrial espionage, such as in the case of Huawei. The U.S. has tried to persuade European allies to ban the Chinese telecommunications company from supplying their 5G networks. But on Tuesday, the EU announced it will allow carriers to install Huawei equipment.
What we're talking about is a process that will be based on a thorough analysis of the risks and vulnerabilities.
After the Beijing negotiations this week, Chinese Vice Premier Liu He will come to Washington at the beginning of April for the ninth round of talks. Patsy Wittakuswara, VOA News at the White House.
Happening now in Asia, Cathay Pacific Group is acquiring budget regional carrier HK Express, which will continue to operate as a low-cost carrier. The company, which operates Cathay Pacific Airways, said Wednesday it will pay a total of $628 million U.S. dollars for HK Express, which will remain a separate brand. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We are happy you're with us. The top U.S. commander on the Korean Peninsula says he does not see signs that North Korea is moving toward denuclearizing. AP correspondent Sankar Magani reports from the White House.
At last summer's Singapore summit, a joint U.S.-North Korea statement said the regime committed to working toward denuclearization. Since then, it's become clear the two nations disagree on just what that means.
Their activity that we've observed is inconsistent with denuclearization.
General Robert Abrams, when asked if there's been any recent change in the North's production of nuclear weapons and material and missiles, Abrams told a House panel he's seen little or no change in North Korea's broader military capability, which he said remains a threat to the U.S., South Korea, and other allies.
The first steps towards creating a better future for all Koreans have already begun. We have witnessed multiple presidential summits, inter-Korean dialogue, and international support to sanctions. The steps agreed to last April at Panmunjom and specified later in the Comprehensive Military Agreement, combined with the aforementioned diplomatic efforts, have all contributed to a marked reduction in tension on the peninsula and created mechanisms for the development of cooperation and confidence building, essential ingredients to the incremental process of making history on the peninsula. Still, I remain clear-eyed about the fact that despite a reduction in tensions along the demilitarized zone and a cessation of strategic provocations, coupled with public statements of intent to denuclearize, little to no verifiable change has occurred in North Korea's military capabilities.
Sagar Magani at the White House.
Coming up, a test in India brings a new participant into a new space race. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news alert now from VOA Asia. The United States is seeking to put the head of a Pakistan-based militant group blamed by India for a February 14th suicide attack that killed 40 Indian soldiers in Kashmir on the UN sanctions blacklist. The resolution circulated to Security Council members Wednesday and obtained by the Associated Press would impose a travel ban and freeze the assets of Jaish-e-Mohammed chief Masood Azhar. India says it has successfully tested a new anti-satellite missile, marking another major development in its budding space program. Prime Minister Narendra Modi announced Wednesday in a nationally televised address that scientists had destroyed a satellite orbiting about 300 kilometers above Earth's atmosphere in a mission that lasted only 3 minutes. Prime Minister said the country has now registered its name as a space power alongside the United States, China, and Russia. Joining us on VOA Asia is Joe Cirincione of the Plowshares Fund. And Joe, what's your reaction to this?
Well, India now has become only the fourth country that can do this. This is a little bit of we told you so. When the U.S. and the Soviet Union started testing these weapons, many of us warned that if you kept doing this, that other countries would follow, and this would make it extremely dangerous, and we would end up being the loser. The U.S. has more satellites in space than any other country, in fact, than most countries combined. India has now followed suit. It won't be the last unless we do something about this. And I would have to disagree with Mr. Modi. I don't think India has become a space power. It already was that. It already has the ability to launch satellites. Today it became a space polluter. The test has now put in orbit hundreds of particles, maybe thousands of debris particles, any one of which could destroy a peaceful commercial satellite if it hits it.
This seems to be a different trajectory from what we have grown up with as far as space travel is concerned, landing men on the moon, research, scientific findings. How did we get here?
During the last years of the Cold War, the U.S. and the Soviet Union started to play around with weapons that could knock each other's satellites out of space, mainly surveillance satellites. India is now taking notice of this, and this is almost certainly aimed at knocking Pakistan satellites. Just in the last year, Pakistan launched two surveillance satellites using a Chinese launch to do that, and it may be that India is sending a message to Pakistan. It's also aimed at China, a threat to knock out China's weapons. It's also a little bit of an electoral ploy. Mr. Moody's up for election in a few weeks, and he's trying to show that he's tough, and so there's never underestimate the domestic parts of this. The danger is that this is part of a new arms race that we're in. Countries are building new nuclear weapons. They're developing new anti-satellite weapons now. They're developing new anti-missile weapons. And the U.S., which used to take the lead in curtailing these kinds of arms races, is sitting on the sidelines.
Well, the other side of this story is that if other nations could be foes of us, whoever us might be, that we have to protect ourselves from a possible attack from a satellite.
Well, that is true. So you have, in the U.S., you see a new push for a space force. And what they mean is they want to have a space warfare capability. So to put up weapons in space, to put up perhaps armed, human beings in space vehicles that could orbit and then come back down, that could use space as a place to attack other countries. Well, if you're going to start doing that, then yes, people are going to start developing anti-satellite weapons. And the threat is really that in the process of doing this, in the process just of testing these weapons, you could have severe international commercial implications.
What do you do about it?
You have to have an anti-satellite treaty. And people have been suggesting this for years. You can do this. You can get countries to agree not to deploy these kinds of weapons. It's the U.S. thought it would have a unique advantage in this field. The Indian test shows that that's just not true. We have to nip this in the bud before we have dozens of countries testing these kinds of weapons.
Joe Cirincione, who heads the Plowshares Fund here in Washington. Joe, once again, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
This news alert from VOA Asia, U.S. President Donald Trump said he met with the chief executive of Alphabet Incorporated's Google Wednesday and discussed political fairness and the company's business in China. Top U.S. General, Marine General Joseph Dunford, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, told a Senate committee that the Chinese military was benefiting from the work Google was doing in China. Now on VOA Asia, for centuries, music has been a big part of the Afghan culture. But during Taliban rule, it was considered un-Islamic and was banned. Now, even though there appears to be some potential for an eventual settlement with the Taliban to end the fighting, local Afghan music lovers fear that the future of music in Afghanistan might be in danger if the militant group ever regains power. VOA's Talal Mirzad recently visited a street in Kabul known for its musical roots. His report narrated by Bezan Hamdard.
There's a saying in Afghanistan, music is food for the soul, and music can now be heard everywhere on Kabul's streets. But under the Taliban, the percussion sounds of the tabla, acoustic tunes of the rabab, or gentle sound waves of the trumpet were not allowed. In fact, all music was banned. After the Taliban's exit in 2001, music thrived once again. But now music fans are worried that U.S. peace talks with the Taliban might put Afghan music in jeopardy once again.
We have not had any meeting with Khalilzad, the U.S. representative for Afghanistan, or the Afghan government about our concerns about the music industry. But I am sure they are aware of our concerns. After the details of peace talks are clear, we will announce our official stance.
Locals call Kharabat Street Kabul's main hub for music. Here you can find local bands and shops that sell or repair music instruments. For years under the Taliban, this street was silent. While locals here welcome peace talks, they do so with hesitation.
We want the government to establish peace, but a peace that includes us. We don't want a peace that excludes us. We want to be part of it so that we can love our country through music.
But concerns go beyond music.
The government must keep everything in mind in any agreement, including music, film, women's rights, people's overall freedom. The government's constitution should be kept. And of course, we are all thirsty for peace.
And if things go back to the old ways, then we will be forced to migrate back out of the country.
While everyone hopes for peace, the musicians and their fans worry about the fate of this long and beloved tradition in their homeland. For Jalal Mirzad in Kabul, Afghanistan, Bejan Hamdard, VOA News.
I think that it's a very big deal culturally what we're doing to bring these, especially Afghanistan and America, together in music, because music speaks all languages.
Greenway Enter teacher and musical partner Masood Omari play tabla, an Eastern percussion instrument, every day in Greenway's basement outside Washington. They call this colorfully decorated studio Tablasphere.
We play three different kinds of music. We play classical music and we play traditional music of Afghanistan and India. And we play new music for the new world, we call it. It's our signature music, and it is composed by Masood. It's for two tabla players.
Greenway from Erie, Pennsylvania, and Omari from Kabul, Afghanistan, met 8 years ago at an Afghan antique and textile shop in Washington.
And I realized that he was this amazing tabla player, and I asked for lessons. I didn't know at the time where this was going. All I knew is that I had a huge desire and a force pushing me to learn to play the instrument.
Greenway had a career in visual arts and has been a lifelong lover of all kinds of music. Coming to tabla has been a natural evolution for her.
When I saw first Abigail, she doesn't understand the language of Afghanistan. She understand the beat and melody. She was very exciting to learn, and she learned quickly.
I felt this amazing challenge, and I wanted to play the music. I just couldn't, I wasn't getting there fast enough for me. You know, I wanted to get there now. I practiced many, many hours. I practice every day.
Greenway has also learned to play harmonium from Omari.
I never thought I would be playing the harmonium, so I had my first lesson on the harmonium. I fell in love with it.
After devoting years to intense study and practice, the duo formed Tabla for Two. Omari fled Afghanistan when he was 15 and resettled in Islamabad. There he studied tabla and received his mastership before coming to the U.S. in 2002.
But what's really extraordinary is that Masood is singing and playing tabla at the same time. That is exciting.
The duo plays at embassies, museums, universities, and at the Tablasphere for special invited guests. They also have videos on their YouTube channel.
I believe that I have an important role playing and preserving the music of my country, Afghanistan, and sharing it with the world.
It's just the beginning. I've just started learning about a place that I knew nothing about that has been so ravaged, and I'm thrilled to show Afghanistan in a positive, beautiful light.
For producer Jun So, I'm Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
You have been listening to VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Our thanks to Director Tracy Carter, our engineer Nelson Lopes. Have a great day.